share market,
the S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is the last people in Australia, apparently, to have never used Afterpay. That's right, we are pretty much on our Pat Malone, if you believe the news and stories out there. We will talk about Afterpay, but first, with me, I'm Scott Phillips, with me is Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, and this Happy New Year to our listeners.
This is the first time we've been together in the studio in 2019. We have had some podcasts going through the whole Christmas and New Year break. You've been away, I understand.
I have been away.
How was the break?
It was great. Awesome. Visiting different places.
Very nice, very nice. Any investing takeaways? Completely off script.
Some, you know, like a couple of different things. At least one takeaway maybe about Uber.
Oh, okay.
Is that Uber is very popular in places like India.
Would you say it's Uber popular?
Uber.
Uber popular, super.
Uber is uber popular, that's it. in India, for example.
Okay.
But, you know, one of the things I discovered is that so Ola, which is the Uber competitor, is also very popular. So everybody has both Ola and Uber. But there's a lot of rising discontent. I asked every driver, because we used Uber a lot,
right,
and I asked each one of them, you know, how's it working out? And they said, you know, the initial days were really great. The fares were really high.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we all went out and took loans, car loans, and bought these cars. And, you know, initially it was working out awesomely well. And now we're just struggling to make our payments and things like that. And as soon as we make our payments, we are off Uber.
Man, okay.
So that's my takeaway.
That kind of sounds a little bit like what's happened in Australia, right? The high fares to get drivers in, all of a sudden the fares drop.
And then you squeeze them.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
The gig economy is a topic we should probably discuss at a later date, but we're not going to do that now, and I apologize for going off script. Today, instead, we are going to talk about a bit of macro, a bit of what's going on in the broader economic world, including interest rates and unemployment. We will talk about Afterpay, as I mentioned. It's in the news again this week. It is the catnip for headline writers around the country.
Mm.
Afterpay again in the news, and there is some validity to why it was in the news. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about new digital banks that are on the march. So, you know what next for some of the big guys? And because we love to, we're going to dip into the Motley Fool mailbag. We had a heap of questions over the last few weeks, which we love desperately. So, Fools, thank you for taking the time, sending in your questions, comments, and feedback. We love them. We want more, as always. I'll put in a quick plug now. If you do want to get in contact, info@fool.com.au. That's I-N-F-O, info. At fool.com.au, or hit us up on Twitter, which is probably the best place because we can interact with you. Your fellow members can see what's going on at The Motley Fool AU. Surprise, surprise. I'm at TMF Scott P. And Doc is at Anirban Mahanty. You can get any or all of us, and we'll have a chat on Twitter.
Of course.
Now, mate, let's go to the big macro and some really, really good. In the face of all the doom and gloom of past months, the stock market's been in a bit of a funk. It hasn't been a great time to be an investor. Lots of bad news on the horizon. This one was pretty good. Unemployment in Australia now down to 5.0%.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployment in New South Wales, the lowest since at least 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So I do my math quickly. That's 41 odd years. That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's really great. But, you know, if you want to be a pessimist, you can say, hey, how, you know, this is the best as it gets, and now it's going to get worse.
Oh, jeez.
I'm just giving you a different
take. You're miserable if the unemployment's high. You're miserable if it's low. Can we not have some positivity somewhere around here?
Yeah, I think this is the surprising thing, right? I mean, you know, there's talk that the retail numbers are not looking good. There's talk that the foot traffic in malls are down. You know, so in the face of that, there have been some downgrades from companies. In the face of all that, this is a very positive news, right? So, I mean, there's maybe, you know, the contradiction in themes. You know, the stock market is not happy. Some companies are not, you know, making their ends meet, but employment numbers are rising. I'll point out one thing, though. The full-time employment was down. And
still finding things to complain about.
And part-time employment was up. So, you know, in aggregate, it was up. But, I mean, you know, we should keep that in mind. The other thing I was thinking, you know, well, but it's, again, seasonally adjusted. But, you know, December generally has, you know, a lot of casual workers coming in to provide, you know, help with, let's say, the tills at shops. And, you know, so there's extra activity that happens at that time. But, you know, nonetheless, again, as I've always said, you know, there are headwinds, but this is a positive among the headwinds. So yeah, it's a tick in my box.
Damned with faint praise, I think we call this one. I'm going to be unabashedly optimistic, mate, because I like to be, and I think it's the right thing. I'm pretty happy to see the unemployment numbers going the right way. The question, of course, the bigger question for me is really the and we talked about this a little bit off air, the challenge of what's happening with wages. You know, in a normal world, in kind of, you know, in the past, in economic orthodoxy, what's supposed to happen is unemployment decreases, as employment goes up, wages are supposed to go up as well because there are fewer workers, companies have to pay more to get people to come and work for them. That's kind of been supposed to have happened for the last couple of years.
But it hasn't.
Some of our wonkier listeners will have heard the term NIRU before, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. One of my favorites, and one of the pollies was caught on that on A Current Affair, or one of those shows once. The idea is basically at some point, there's supposed to be a level of employment or unemployment before which there is no inflation, and after which wage inflation starts to creep in. We just haven't seen that yet. And I think that's the biggest A question, and B, I think to some degree, it's the thing that's holding back the economy more than most. If we'd have seen some wage inflation over the last couple of years, we probably see an increase in spending and a bit more solidity in the kind of the basic physical economy that really hasn't come through because most people don't have any more money in their pockets to spend despite the fact that unemployment's falling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would hypothesize that, you know, if the employment is coming from casual work and part-time employment, maybe that's part of the reason why, you know, it's not going up is, you know, maybe there are plenty of people who want casual work, you know, who can... are looking for casual work and getting them, you know, and businesses are able to get them when they want,
and then again
release them when they don't want. So
yeah, it's probably true. Part-time work. I mean, part-time work is permanent, so to some degree that's partly true. I think the other thing for me is that there's one of my favorite economists who I do appear on Your Money with, the Old Sky Business, Stephen Roberts from Alexander Funds Management. He's also mentioned that while individual per hour wages haven't increased, the actual household income has increased by about 6% year on year simply because there are more people in the workforce. And so while you're not getting more money, I'm not getting more money, if more members of our family are working, the household income actually goes up, even if the per person per hour wage doesn't increase. And again, that's not to say it's okay, but that's giving some context as to why there's a bit of positivity in the economy. And hopefully, for all of our sakes, it's enough to keep the economy rolling forward.
So if the inflation is minimal and household income actually goes up 6%, that's actually a net positive, right? Quite a bit of a net positive.
You know what? So I'm gonna rant a little. We haven't had a high horse for a while, and I will have one at the end of this podcast if I remember and we don't run out of time. To your point about that, I think that's one of the big... one of my big bugbears is that sense of people would rather, if you ask most people, sorry, that no one would admit it, right? But psychologically, most of us would rather a 5% pay increase in a 6% inflation environment when we're actually going backwards, rather get a 2% wage increase with a 1% inflation rate. We like bigger numbers. It feels like we're getting more money, even though our money's buying less. In the first case, our purchasing power is decreasing. In the second case, even though we're getting less in terms of extra dollars, actual dollars, their purchasing power is increasing. Most of us feel better about a larger increase, even in a higher inflation environment. I'm pretty sure economic confidence would be higher if we had higher inflation and
higher wages,
but less high than the current situation, because we're all used to looking at that one number in the bank account saying, is it going up or not, rather than genuinely, do I have more money to spend? I think that's the big one.
We need fake inflation.
Get Donald Trump onto it.
Yeah.
Well, fake inflation. I like it. Go with fake news.
You know, I don't talk politics. You know? I have no opinion about politics.
I'm just referring to the fake news one.
I'm not opinionated.
Oh, mate, I am. Just stick around. Hey, follow me on Twitter if you want some opinions. I'm good at that. I try not to be particularly political, partisan, I'll say. I don't mind being a little bit political. I try not to be partisan. I try and swing barbs both ways when they're deserved. And I've certainly had my go at both the left and the right of politics recently. But we'll leave that one alone.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, speaking of the economy, and this is one I know has been near and dear to your heart, basically because you're a bear and you hate property. We saw this...
I don't hate anything.
By the way, I set that up and just kept talking.
Oh, yeah.
But this week, the NAB was the last of the big four banks. After promising not to, NAB has come out and increased the variable interest rates pretty much across the board. Every NAB customer is going to be paying more, almost every customer with a variable loan, as a result of this announcement. Now, we've talked a little bit in the past about the reasons why. Just recap those a little bit and what you're thinking about after the NAB kind of rise goes through.
So when NAB actually made that statement that they're going to keep it on hold and not increase it, I thought it was very bold. For a CEO to do that, it's actually very bold. And the reasons we have talked about this before, and for those people, for those who have listened to us before, this is like going to be sound like a repeat. But for those who haven't, this is, you know, a refresher. I think the magic here is that, let's say we get 50% or 60% of our funds that, you know, borrowers get, they come from, let's say, our depositors or local economy, right? And then let's say 40% of the funds come from overseas, what they call the wholesale markets, which is basically going overseas and saying, can we borrow money from you?
Right. So they take right. they take 3/5 of their money from Australian depositors
yeah.
and 2/5, 40% by going overseas and saying, hey, can we borrow some money from overseas? Because there's not enough deposit cash here
yeah.
to fund all loans Australians want to take out.
Exactly.
Right.
So now when that happens, then you have to pay the overseas folks interest, right? And let's assume that you're going to the US, which is one of the world's largest money markets, then you're going to be, you know, the amount of money interest you're going to be paying is going to be decided by to at least a large extent by the interest rates prevailing in that economy, or in this case, the US Fed, right? So US Federal Reserve, which is essentially the RBA equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
The US Fed, which is the RBA equivalent, has been increasing rates, which means the cost of borrowing money from overseas is going up. And while RBA here has not, which basically means the cost of borrowing money locally, which is taking the depositors' money, mm-hmm. has not mm-hmm. gone up.
Right.
But when you put the two together, it basically means that the cost of money borrowing money has gone up.
Right.
Of course, for 40% of it, but it still has gone up.
So half your costs remain stable, the other yeah. half of your costs increase.
Increase.
If you don't pass on higher... So think about this as a manufacturing company, right?
Yeah.
If you've got cost of goods, let's say you make a product that has two components, two pieces, two ingredients. The first ingredient costs the same, the second ingredient costs more.
Yeah.
Your cost of goods goes up. Either you've got to increase prices, or you've got to have smaller margins and make less money.
Exactly. And you know, as a bank CEO, you've got to be really, really bold, because your shareholders are going to come with, you know, pitchforks, knives, uh-huh. and, you know, chainsaws and whatnot. If you know, you're making less money than last year, right? I mean, those NAB shareholders want their dividends. They want their dividends to go up. And I mean, as a shareholder, that's what we want, right?
Right.
I mean, so there's a fine balance here
yeah.
To strike. I mean, I thought NAB was bold. And I think all banks have no choice but to do this.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, if we want our banking system to, you know, work the way it works, and, you know, it works well, this has to happen. So I think it's not unexpected. I would say that, you know, if you didn't pay extra interest for the last 1 year or whatever, you know, 6 months that NAB gave you, you know, you got a benefit. So this, you know, again, this headwind is going to be there, and it's going to be, I think, you know, we are in a rising interest rate environment. So I think that's the headwind. And I expect that to be there. You know, that's largely my take on property, is that, you know, cost of borrowing is going up. And if your debt loads are very high, then, you know, cost of servicing that goes up.
Mm.
And that therefore has other impacts, which is, you know, if you're paying more to service your loan, then you have less money left in your pocket, which therefore means that you have less money to spend, which therefore means there's less money to go around. And, you know, and so on. So it's one of the headwinds. But again, employment numbers going up, and, you know, on average, household income going up, which is good.
We hope that household income keeps going up enough to offset the rising costs, because, as you say, that combined with the potential removal of negative gearing, a whole lot of concerns around what happens to confidence.
Yeah.
I'm an optimist, but I have to say there are always very credible reasons why things could go badly.
Yeah.
2019 is a year where a couple of them seem pretty credible, and more importantly, if they happen at the same time and compound each other,
yeah.
that's kind of when you start to worry a little bit about. I don't particularly care about housing prices either way. I'm not an investor. I own my own home, but
yeah.
I'm not selling it anytime in the next, hopefully, 15, 20 years, so it doesn't matter. I don't care at all. But what I do care about is that if the wealth effect increases the likelihood of a recession or some sort of economic downturn,
yeah.
That would be a pretty ugly thing to have happen. So
absolutely, yeah. So yeah,
hopefully we won't be political, but hopefully the politicians are listening.
Yeah, it's a lot of things actually coming together sort of at the wrong time, maybe, is the thing. You know, again, there are benefits to house pricing going down, house prices going down, which is, you know, makes more affordable for the people who are actually out of the market, right? So, but, you know, again, I don't want to get into political debate about this, you know, but yeah, I think there are some headwinds, and we got to watch for that. But, you know, there are good news and bad news, and that's what, you know, makes life. There's always, you know, we all want all good news all the time, but, you know.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
From NAB to Afterpay. Do you like how I did that? Kind of financing, spending, economics. It's almost kind of the same thing. Did I get away with it?
Not really.
Okay, all right. Yeah. I tried, and that's really important.
That counts.
We get participation marks. We get effort marks here at the Motley Fool Money Podcast. So
it's commendable. Well done.
Thank you, mate. So that's all I need. A bit of praise goes a long way, Don. Afterpay was in the news this week, and it's one of those kind of perennial headline grabbers for a whole lot of different reasons. This week it was about whether or not Afterpay was using some data from the electoral roll that, depending on the allegation, depending on the reading of the legislation, it shouldn't have been using, at least not for that particular purpose. The electoral roll does allow, or the Australian Electoral Commission, I should say, does allow access to the electoral roll for particular purposes, mm-hmm. but not for just any purpose. Mm-hmm. And there was some concern that maybe Afterpay and its ilk, and there's many others caught up in this kind of potential concern, are using the data for purposes they weren't supposed to be using it for. Mm. So that was in the news. Another kind of, one more bear strike against Afterpay if you're so inclined. Mm. On the flip side, this is a business that's still growing like a weed. Mm-hmm. It has made some decent but still very, very small strides, relatively speaking, to the US. Mm-hmm. I love the Afterpay story from a purely, as a business person, as someone who loves business and likes to see some Australian companies kind of, take on the world and win. Afterpay as a business literally created a brand new way of paying. Mm-hmm. It convinced, I don't know if it's the majority of merchants, but an absolute truckload of merchants to accept this new way of paying. Australian consumers have adopted it at a massive rate of knots. This is an unbridled success story of an Australian company who have innovated really cleverly. This isn't necessarily new software being written. It isn't necessarily new ways of working necessarily. But just if you can take on Amex, Visa, MasterCard, whatever else, pick your debit cards, Google Pay, Apple Pay, a million other options. To have absolutely blown a hole in that and found your own space is pretty bloody impressive. The concern with Afterpay, of course, is A, does the business survive in the same form if it's regulated differently? And B, is it worth the money that's being charged for its shares? So although we can leave the electoral roll question aside, I think it's probably not a big deal in the overall story. Maybe they get told to stop using it. Maybe it's okay. Maybe they get fined a small amount of money. It's kind of immaterial. But the Afterpay story does... But people love it. People love hearing about it, talking about it. It's the one company on Twitter. If I'm ever game enough to say something negative, I get jumped on by half a dozen Afterpay fans who accuse me of talking it down. So just kind of give me your thoughts on Afterpay as a business, where it's at, kind of how you're seeing the company, and then to some degree, how you're seeing the shares.
I want to take a first cut at your segue because I'm going to disagree with two things.
Oh, no.
Number one, I think this, so the story, there's so many stories on Afterpay and it's a clickbait. So, I read half of it, but what I found interesting about this clickbait, it was about data privacy. Mm. And I think that's something that I have seen a lot spoken about lately, especially
data. Speaking of segues, you've taken this on a lovely tangent, but keep going.
No. So data broking is something that's receiving a lot of attention, and I think Europe was the first one to come up with GDPR, which basically tries to protect users' data and how the user's data is being used.
So GDPR was the general something privacy something?
Yeah, it's a privacy regulation, basically, I forgot the full name, it's a crappy name.
Doesn't matter,
But it's a privacy regulation, which is basically trying to, give back the right of the data to the users at a very high level.
Yep.
So I found that as an interesting take this is a popular culture thing, right? I mean, once people talk about stuff, it comes into public culture, then politicians start talking about it, then there's regulation and so on. So I think that angle was interesting. The other thing I would say is I don't think Afterpay is actually in the same space competing with Visa, MasterCard, Apple Pay, Google Pay, or whatever else is there, because I think none of those other guys are actually in the space of, buy now, pay later, right? They're not in that space. They're basically just facilitating contactless payment or they're basically facilitating the move from cash to electronic ways of paying. This is really, I think the innovation here was basically, bringing consumption forward as much as you can, bringing consumption of small goods forward by some amount of time. I think that's the innovation here. And so it's basically another form of debt, right? You can call it even payday lending type of approach, right? So it has been, this sort of thing has existed in one form or the other. What they did, I think, is they appealed to certain demographic and did it really well, using the smartphone and then, of course, building the network of the retailers. So I think that's a real big checkbox. So
I will take a slight disagreement, though I'll agree a little bit. To my mind, the competition piece is it's a different way to pay, and they've wriggled their way into a payment system, payment oligopoly, call it what you will, where, yes, though it's right happening now, but to some extent, those consumers, if they stay with this product into their 20s and 30s or whatever, most people have an Afterpay account or seem to have an Afterpay account these days. The alternatives were cash, credit card, or debit card. Now it's cash, credit card, debit card, or Afterpay. And to some degree, every dollar being spent, there's a portion of that that would have been spent using another payment method that's now being used on Afterpay, what I would argue. I don't think it's purely incremental, almost by definition.
Sure. But what I'm saying is that, you know, it's incremental in the sense that, you know, maybe these people would not have spent this money, and they're actually spending this money because they haven't got this form of loan that they can get, right? So it's created, that's what I'm saying, it's created a new demand that probably did not exist. You're right to say that, you know, if the people who are using it today continue using it in this form in the future, then it is an impingement on the territory of the Visas and the MasterCards, right? I look at the other payment technologies as different because they're just enabling the same thing to be paid in different ways, right? So if you're looking at Google Pay, then it's different. You know, it's basically allowing your MasterCard to be used using Google, right? So what I feel here is that there's, you know, a couple of things. The early story from the US is looking promising. So I think that there's a lot of promise there. The question which is not clear is this going to get regulated like any other debt instrument would, you know? And I think that's the risk. And the other thing that I have seen is that Afterpay makes a pretty decent chunk of its revenue from late fees, right?
Yeah, so they do 25% last count.
So that's pretty significant, right? I mean, you know, what does that tell us? Is that people just forgetting about it, or is that people who are not able to pay and therefore paying these late fees, right? So, and I mean, so I feel that regulation might happen. They might get regulated, and I don't know what the impact of that is. So I think I find it it's a fascinating thing. I don't use it personally, but yeah, again, it's fascinating. And you know, I'm someone who's, you know, I was skeptical of it.
Me too.
And I'm less skeptical now that they've been able to, you know, find their way into the US, and they're looking to find their way. They bought someone bought a small company in UK, looking to roll out in the UK. And you know, it could be one of those things where, you know, you roll out enough that, you know, actually legislating it in a way affects consumer mood so much that no one wants to do it. So unless there's a bad outcome from all of this, then, you know, again. So, yeah, I'm a little less bearish right now. Let's say I'm not bullish, but I'm less bearish on Afterpay. That's my take.
Fair enough, too. So I'm going to ask you to go a little bit deeper. Mm-hmm. Not bearish, not bullish, kind of stuff. Current share price, buy, sell, or hold?
In the long term, how is it going to make money? It's making a cut of the, you know, it's a pretty hefty cut that they're making of the retailers, right? Yep. But they're paying pretty hefty interest, right? So the question really is on the money that they're borrowing to give to people to, and then, you know, or not give to people, but to give to the retailer. Yep. So the question really is, this is basically a banking operation. Right. This is basically the equivalent of the net interest margin that they're basically making. It's not a transaction based thing where, you know, more people are spending more and therefore, you know, you're making a cut. It's slightly different to me, in my opinion. So, you know, Afterpay, I would look at it as like a bank, really.
It's kind of both though, right? They make a cut of what's being spent, but they also have the risk that it doesn't get repaid. So as long as it all gets repaid, they're making a set percentage of the fee by definition. They're taking 2-4% from the retailer. If everyone pays it back, that's exactly what they do get.
No, it's not exactly that, right? So let's say the retail, they're getting 5% from the retailer, but for that, they have actually to borrow the money, for which they may be paying 3%. So they're basically making the difference only on it.
Yeah, to some degree. They get to use the cash multiple times a year though, right?
So
it's an annual charge versus a per transaction fee, but I take your point.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, sure.
Yeah. So okay, buy, sell, or hold. I'm gonna make you.
Yeah, so I would put it right now as a hold. I mean,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't sell it if you know, if I held it. The thing is, I don't hold it, but you know, I'm still not convinced.
You're not rushing out to buy it, are you?
I'm not rushing out to buy it. So I'd put it at a hold.
Fair enough. I'm the same, man. I my view, I think I've probably said on the podcast before, I'm pretty sure Afterpay is not worth the current price. If it's successful in the US in particular, it's probably worth a whole lot more, maybe 3-4 times the current price. If the US business ends up being unsuccessful, frankly, I think it's overpriced at the current price. I think it kind of, to me, it feels like zero or 5-7 years ago when the zero was at $50. It was one of those businesses that had a whole lot of hope into it based on what it might do in the US. It wasn't able to break through in the US in a big way, at least not yet.
Yeah.
And the price kind of fell, and then its kind of profits grown back into the previous price about now. So you've broken even over 5 years, which is pretty decent. It's not a terrible result, but to some degree, that was the expectation that was built in that didn't come to pass. Now, if Afterpay can make it come to pass in a different universe, Xero was successful in the US and is now worth $200 a share. Xero had that issue. Afterpay may or may not be able to get to the same result.
I think that what I'll add is that in the Xero case, there was a nimble competitor in QuickBooks there, which they had to defend. Whereas it's not clear to me who the competitor is for them in the US. Maybe, you know,
Afterpay, you mean?
Yeah, Afterpay. So maybe that's the advantage they have. But you're right. I mean, if somebody wants to compete, if PayPal, for example, wants to compete with them, then it'll be hard.
That's the question, right?
Yeah.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of disruption, speaking of competing, speaking of digital money, how's that for another segue? I'm on fire,
Doc. That's great.
The new year, 2019 is going to be my year for segues, mate. I'm all over this like
you're
a rash.
You're winning it.
All over it like a fat kid on cake. Mate, digital banking.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot of digital banks that have sprung to life recently. Either organically from other businesses or businesses that are starting up specifically to be digital banks. On one hand, I kind of feel like we've seen this story before. We've had the ING Directs that came to Australia. We had Nubank from NAB. We have Dragon Direct. There's plenty of online banking has, of course, been a very, very big hit in Australia. We tend to be one of the fastest technological adopters in the world, and we've certainly done that with internet banking. On one hand, what's new about online banking, not much. On the other hand, there's a whole lot of new banks that are seeing some opportunity somewhere.
Mm.
So tell me, is this an echo of last time, full of sounding fury, signifying nothing, or is this genuinely a revolution? Should banks and bank shareholders fear the rise of digital banks, or is this just more of the same and business will go on as usual?
I mean, it's a difficult one. Vault Bank got its license to be, you know, become a deposit-taking institution.
Right.
And they also got the $250,000, you know, the deposit guarantee of the federal government. So that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question is, can they get deposits? And, you know, and to get those deposits, you know, how much are they going to pay?
Yeah, right.
In terms of interest, right? So, I mean, becoming a deposit-taking institution gives you flex in terms of, you know, how, you know, your lending capacity,
funding
right?
sources, right?
Your
exactly.
funding sources.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's a leg up for them.
Yep.
And I mean, it's hard because I think we are in a scenario where I think the the lending growth is probably going to be, you know, slow and steady, right? Mm-hmm. Not increasing.
Yep.
So if that's the, you know, it's going to be a very competitive environment. So I think it's going to be a competitive environment for everyone. The one that I thought is interesting, and I don't think the license has been approved, is the one called WeBank,
right?
Which is from which is, I think, majority owned by Tencent.
Okay.
Right. Now,
this is coming from WeChat. Is that the same kind of business?
Yeah, WeBank, right, okay. WeChat, you know, so Tencent. Now, that one I find interesting because, you know, it can be capitalized by a very big company, right? That's a mammoth company. Now, and there are other risks that come with that, you know, so there are, you know, maybe some sovereign risks involved with, you know, letting a big company with such clout come and have open a bank.
Right.
So I think if someone came and wanted to disrupt it and, you know, came with, you know, seeded with capital, then it could be very disruptive and it would be disruptive for our incumbents. Net result might be that it's actually good for consumers, but yeah, we'll see. So I find the WeBank news interesting, but I don't think they have the license yet. They filed a bunch of, you know, they've registered trade names and things like that. So that I think is interesting.
And do you, so if you think about that, what does this mean for our banks, if anything? What's your view on digital banking, the kind of march of disruption? It's kind of, on one hand, it's easy to think, gee, the banks are old and staid and not doing much, and this new breed of disruption that's happening everywhere else in the world, banking's next. On the other hand, as I said, I kind of feel like we've kind of seen this story a little bit before. I feel like banking needs, digital bank needs kind of a killer app, to use the phrase. I feel like if Commonwealth Bank gives me, just to pick a bank, gives me online banking and net banking and Apple Pay and Google Pay, and I kind of don't need to change my account to a WeBank or to a Vault or to a somebody else who's coming out of the blue, unless they kind of give me a really, really good reason to. ING Direct couldn't do it. In fact, ING sold out to ANZ that now owns ING Direct in Australia. We've seen the other banks. It seems like disruption kind of hasn't really caught hold, partly to give the banks credit because they've responded really well to it. They're amongst some of the technological leaders worldwide when it comes to banking. Is this another echo of a coulda, shoulda, woulda, or is this genuinely something they should be worried about?
Well, I mean, again, I would not be worried about it. I mean, I think that the opportunity here is that, you know, the operating cost for an online-only bank should be lower than a brick-and-mortar bank, right?
Right.
Now, you would argue that, you know, the same would have been true for, say, ING and so on. But I think ING was a different beast in some sense, right? Because ING, I mean, is a big bank, is worldwide operated, has, you know, probably comes with a different culture, and maybe a wee bank comes with a different culture. And, you know, and if they want to be really aggressive, they could actually up significantly the interest they're willing to pay on deposits, and therefore right. grab deposits, right? So I think a big foray by in online banking from mm-hmm. a company like Tencent, which is an online leader in so many different things, can actually change the game.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, because, you know, that's
right,
the things that they've done, for example, using WeChat in China is pretty amazing. So, you know, they've really created their own ecosystem inside WeChat. So I think I think I would not, I would treat an online entry by WeBank as a very significant move. I don't know Volt well enough, you know, it's a privately held company to have a comment, but I know that Tencent is a very innovative company. And therefore, their entry could mean something.
So it's almost that kind of tech heritage to some degree, the culture, the call it what you will, the way of working of that business, because it's so different to what we're used to from financial services, that maybe it's kind of just going to bring something different to the table that maybe we can't foresee. But it's different from Bank A trying to revolutionize Bank B.
Yeah.
If you're a tech company trying to revolutionize
banking.
Payments and finance, yeah. it's a different story.
And it's a very profitable tech company. Right, and it's one of the largest tech companies in the world. Just people just don't realize it.
And question without notice, but you know the answer. If one of our listeners said, "Hey, that Tencent thing sounds interesting," mm-hmm. how can you get access to Tencent from Australia?
You can actually. You can buy an ETF from
exchange traded fund.
Exchange traded fund from BetaShares, which is called Asia. Which holds?
What is that called, Asia? That's the ASIC code.
That is, it's called Asia. It's an Asia ETF,
and ASIA. Okay.
Yeah, and the code is also ASIA. funny enough, they had the code, I guess, available.
Nice.
That holds the 50x, excluding Japan, largest tech companies in Asia.
Right.
Which are primarily domiciled in Asia, whose business is in Asia. You can get exposure to Tencent, one of the largest holdings.
So there. The 50 largest. Companies in Asia, ex-Japan and ex-financials, do I remember that correctly?
It's tech. It's only tech. So it's tech companies.
Okay.
And when ex, it's ex, and it's, I think it's ex-Australia as well. It's basically it's basically the Asia component minus Japan.
Cool. Nice. And we would say that's probably a good exposure to have?
That is, I think it's a great exposure to have.
Okay.
You know, if you believe in the rise of Asia over the long term, then I think it's a great exposure.
And as part of a balanced portfolio, of course.
Like anything.
Goes without saying.
Yeah.
Correct.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
And let's move on to one of our favorite parts of the Motley Fool Money podcast, and that is a dip deep into the Fool mailbag. I've already given the details, so I won't bore you with that again, though I may do it towards the end. Fools, as I said, we love hearing your comments, questions, feedback, and suggestions, and we got a heap over the last couple of weeks, and as I said, this is the first one we've been together for a couple of weeks, so we're going to work through the mailbag over the next 2 weeks, maybe even three if we get some more good questions. Please throw them at us, as always. If that's what you want to hear from us, that's what we want to talk about rather than making it up ourselves. As much as Doc loves talking about property and as much as I love bagging him about Apple, because that's just what we both like to do, we'd much rather actually getting your feedback and suggestions. All right, so here's the first one, Doc. A question. Hi, guys. Love the show. I tell you what, they know how to sweet talkers, don't they? just wondering if you have any insight on what has gone on with Retail Food Group. Oh, dear. This is one of the worst stocks, very, very worst stocks of 2018. Mm. It was seen as a good investment not all that long ago. That was true. I was once recommending that stock to our members, unfortunately, and now it is down to 30 cents.
Oh.
I saw in the news that there could be a Chinese buyout on the horizon. Does that make the current rock bottom price attractive in your eyes? And Doc, because I get to ask the question, I'm going to ask you to answer it. I won't leave you swinging completely. I will offer a suggestion. But your thoughts on Retail Food Group, it was 30 odd cents then. I don't imagine it's changed too much. I'm just going to stall for time while I type in the code. Mm. And I see the price is exactly still 30 cents. So there you go. Tell us your thoughts on RFG.
So number one thought is that, you know, buying something because there's speculation that somebody else is going to buy it and therefore you're going to get a buyout price, mm-hmm. which is going to be higher than the current price. That's a gamble.
Yep.
And, you know, the odds are that you win or the odds are that you lose. Maybe they're 50-50. I don't know.
Yeah.
With Retail Food Group, I think they have debt problems that they have to deal with. And
most specifically, debt covenant that if they breach, the banks can effectively foreclose on them. So it's partly whether they can afford to repay it is almost the secondary issue.
Yeah.
The first one is they've made some promises to the bank that basically say, hey, you can call our loans if we don't do these three or four things.
Yeah.
Right now, they can't do a couple of them. So unless the banks continue to be kind,
they have trouble.
The axe is hanging over the neck.
Yeah. Yep. And so they have some earnings that they need to meet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably going to be negative in their earnings given their scenario with how they've been selling their franchises. So, no, I mean, it's, you know, is it a turn? It's not yet a turnaround in my view. Mm. It's kind of far from it. It's basically in the sick bay. Mm. I would call it, it's in the ICU.
So, and normally, look, it's funny you say that, use that analogy, because Warren Buffett has talked about buying great businesses when they're on the operating table.
Yeah.
So to kind of keep our medical metaphors going, I think what I'm hearing you say is it's not necessarily a Buffett quality business.
So this is not a great business that's in the ICU. It's probably an ordinary business that's in the ICU. An ordinary business in the ICU is pretty risky, pretty dangerous. So I don't rule out somebody might buy it, you know, but you know, somebody might buy it really cheap.
Yeah.
Right. So that's my take.
Plenty of speculation. That wouldn't be the first company who had buyout rumors and then went broke, you know, 2 months later. I can't disagree with you, Doc. I think it's one of those scenarios. Look, it made a heap of money from selling franchises. And right now, no one wants to buy an RFG franchise because there are too many of them around the country.
Yeah.
And if you can't sell franchise, and that's where a large chunk of your profit comes from, then you're kind of on a hiding to nothing. And that's the problem that RFG face. They do look really, really cheap at 30 cents, I have to say. The value hunter in me is looking at that going, what do you reckon?
Mm.
As you say there, mate, the chance this goes to zero effectively because of a bank, a covenant issue, or actually just because they lose money in the banks, so they simply can't pay the loans back, which is possible. Every possibility, it gets put in administration. Now, I will say for what it's worth, that Chinese takeover, or the proposed or the speculated Chinese takeover for only part of the business, which was the crust pizza business, that could actually be more than what the current market cap is, for example. And so there are some real possibilities when it comes to some value creation there, but this is entirely and completely speculation. So there is absolutely a scenario into which this is worth a lot more than 30 cents. There's a scenario where it's worth zero.
Yeah.
And frankly, neither you nor I nor anyone else can really put proper odds on that. This is one of those ones where I feel like if you're an investor and you want to play this game, you kind of have to play the odds across a large number of examples of this. So I'd never buy RFG and say, I'm buying it on the basis of speculation. If you want to and you think you're good enough at buying takeover arbitrage, then maybe, even then I'd probably say no still. But you want to do it over 10 or 15 or 20 examples and make this a core part of your portfolio, knowing you're going to lose on some and win on others. That's a pretty tough
game. So do the sum of parts game. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, the sum of parts game. Yeah. And you need to repeat that many times.
RFG is an avoid still?
I'd say it's a void.
All right.
Motley Fool Money.
Let's move to the next one from Jason on Twitter again. Love it. Hey, team, listening to the podcast, and I agree with your point about the ASX indices being far too weighted towards banks and miners. So I'll stop there very quickly and just say for new listeners, we hope there are a few. We know many, many people join us every week. Firstly, what we've said about we love ETFs. Mm-hmm. We love broad-based ETFs. Ordinarily, we'd be saying to most members, hey, if you don't want to pick stocks, buy a broad index, you know, something that covers roughly the entire market, an ASX 200 or an S&P 500 index, and go with that. I'd love to give that advice. It's cheap. You get the market return. The problem is that banks and miners are about 45-odd, 50, depending on the week, percent of that index. And so you're really not buying a diversified broad index. You're buying a concentrated exposure to banks and miners. So we've said in the past, look, we really struggle with saying that people just buy the index in Australia because it does feel too concentrated. So Jason's saying he agrees with that. So we always appreciate people agreeing with us.
Oh, awesome.
Jason's obviously a very smart man.
Yeah, we love Jason.
Probably very good looking too, I would imagine.
He's great.
Exactly. But then he says, okay, so what are your thoughts on equal weight ETFs rather than market cap weighted ETFs? And again, just to give you a heads up, market cap weighted ETF is the standard ETF. It basically says, hey, if BHP is 10% of the value of the ASX as a market, then it's going to be 10% of the ETF, and it's weighted that way. So if BHP shares go up a couple of percent, that is, you know, higher weighting than something that's only worth 0.1 of 1% of the market, in which case that you only get a very small component. An equal weighted ETF would say, right, 200 companies, each of those is 0.5% of the index. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's BHP or the 200th smallest or the 200th largest company, better put, then, you know, they will go up in equal components based on the share price rises of each company. So if I've explained that well, if I haven't, feel free to clarify, Doc. If I have, what are your thoughts on equal weighted indices?
I think equal weighted is interesting. I mean, a couple of things here. One, I mean, I would like to see actually some back testing results to see actually how it looks without saying, you know, how an equal weighted ETF would have performed historically over the long term.
Right.
Would give you a good sense of how they may perform in the future. Again, you know, past results are no indicator, you know, no guarantee of future results, but gives you a good sense.
Yep.
So I think that's number one. I think the advantage of this approach would be that you'd get a more, you know, sector balance by doing that versus what you said. So I think there's some advantages there. So I like the idea as such. That said, you know, there are many different types of ETFs available, right? So, you know, they have these equal weights, you have sector weights, you've got actively managed. So as an ETF gets more complex, you know, you just have to, you know, cast a very clean eye and have a good look at it. So without having a good look, you know, I don't know whether this is a good one to have, but, you know, the idea sounds interesting to me. Mm. And, you know, I know that there are equal weights available overseas. So that's good. If there are equal weights here, then, you know, gives people more options, at least in terms of diversification.
Yeah, I'm stuck on this one, I have to say. It does help offset the issue of over-concentration, and maybe all else being equal, that'd be an interesting way to go. I have to say, I don't... Part of the value of market cap weighted indices are that the biggest companies are the biggest because they tend to be the best and most profitable and a whole lot of other things like that. And so to some degree, if the point of buying an index ETF is to give yourself the market return, which we think it should be, then once you start to choose any other strategy, you're kind of choosing an active strategy even with a passive instrument. So it's kind of one of those scenarios where, I mean, there are more ETFs in the US now than there are stocks.
Yeah,
there are so many different versions of you can have any sort of active strategy you want. And so ETFs become basically a fee collecting machine, which is exactly what we hate about the financial service industry, is that everyone's trying to find a way to clip the ticket. The idea of a very low fee broad based index is to replace the idea of active stock picking, or to supplement it if you want to have a broad base of your portfolio with a relatively market matching instrument. Mm-hmm. Once you start to go outside that, you start to make bets and say, well, do I think a market weighted index would be better or worse than a market cap one by, you know, this or that other reason? So I think that's, I would, it's an interesting idea. I love the theory. I love chatting about it and kind of weighing up the concept. I have to say, I'd probably not be super keen on it. I don't know that I want the 200th largest ASX company to have the same weight as the 4th largest or 10th largest ASX company, in the sense that you're now betting actively that the small companies will either do better or as well as the larger companies. And that may well be true. And as you said, Doc, you want to see some backtesting. That's probably the answer. Although, again, that assumes that the past is going to look like the future or vice versa. Forced to choose, maybe it's slightly better than a pure market cap weighted one in Australia. Mm. In the US, I'd say absolutely not. I'd absolutely go market cap weighted on the S&P 500. I think that's the smartest thing because you don't have the concentration issues. Here, if I was going to, you know, I'd probably actually hedge my bets and buy half of both is what I probably would do, I think, because then you're not doing yourself out of a favor either way. And if that's the answer to ASX indexing, which is, hey, I want to buy a broad passive index, I'm not comfortable with the market weighted, maybe a bit of both might help to offset some of those risks. So maybe I might do that if I was so inclined, but I'm not a favor of in general, particularly in the US, but maybe it has a place here in Australia.
But maybe the solution to that is just buy the ASX 300 ETF, right? The Vanguard has an ASX 300, a little bit better than the ASX 200.
So the All Ords, for example, is 500 companies-ish.
Yeah.
And it moves only incredibly, incredibly slightly differently to the ASX 200 because the top 10, the top 20 companies are about 66% of the index.
Right.
I was talking about another 100 companies. They're so small in comparison. It's probably something like, and I'll make this up, but something like 5 or 7% difference.
Okay.
Because the market caps you're adding are so incredibly tiny. Because we Australian companies get so small so fast, it's very, very hard for those small ones to make even a modicum of difference.
Mix it with other ETFs is the other solution, right? Just mix it with other ETFs.
Or join one of our services and follow Al.
And buy stock. buy exactly. Stocks. Exactly. Yeah.
A bit of shameless self-promotion there as we get towards the end of the podcast.
Motley Fool Money.
Doc, one last one we had from Power Pig on Twitter at PowerPigDT. I assume DT is PowerPig's initials, although maybe his name's actually PowerPig and or her name is PowerPig and DT is just something else. PowerPig says, and the Motley Fool, love the podcast, guys. Excellent.
Awesome.
I bought Telstra shares about 3 to 4 years ago at 563. Oh, dear. I only say that because I did too. I can't see them ever going up again to those levels. Do I hold out or is it time to sell? Also, what are your thoughts on Wesfarmers now post the Coles demerger? Hold or sell? Now, I will say to some degree that kind of gives PowerPig's view away because they're not asking if we should buy. Mm. So hold or sell are the only options that PowerPig wants to know about, and maybe because he or she already owns Wesfarmers, I would assume. Let's start with Telstra, mate. I'm loathe to ask you the question because
I love answering things sometimes you get confused
with Tesla. But you're a noted Telstra bear.
Mm-hmm.
But at the current price, can you see your way clear to us saying to PowerPig, hey, and we should say we don't give personal advice, this is general advice only, should our listeners be holding their Telstra shares or is it time to part ways?
So I'll answer this in two parts. Okay. Since the question is, should I hold or sell? I mean, it's already at the point where, you know, they don't think it's a buy.
To be fair, PowerPig's already got, so they're not looking to add more shares. Okay. PowerPig obviously already owns them. So do they leave the shares in the portfolio or do they get rid of them and use the money for something else?
So I could answer this. I'll answer this differently again. I'll say, just to be more nuanced, I think if you can find another company or a set of companies that you think are going to deliver higher returns than this one, then you should absolutely sell it, right? Because, you know, if you can find another company that's going to give you better returns or a couple of companies that are going to give you better returns, then why do you want to hold this?
Right.
Even though it may be market beating, right? Yep. I mean, you know, so that's the thing. That's number one.
With the exception that you may have to pay tax and other things. So there are certain reasons why you mightn't want to.
No tax in this case, 563.
In the case of Telstra, there's a tax
loss.
This
is like a tax loss. So this is a perfect one, right?
Yeah, totally.
This is a perfect one. There's no tax issues involved, you know.
Yep.
If you can find something that's going to grow better than this, absolutely sell it, lock the tax and be done with it. That's number one.
Totally.
I think the current prices look reasonable. I'd give it a decent odd.
Does that hurt to say that?
No, it doesn't.
Not about Telstra? Come on.
No, it doesn't. I mean, the thing is, like, you know, at around the $3 mark, it seems like it's a cheap stock. Is it cheap enough? It probably will give market returns, is my guess, at $3. I think anything, you know, once it starts getting to sort of, you know, the 250 zone, I think is cheap.
Mm.
$3, I think, is okay.
Mm.
Yeah, so I think my view is that I think it has got a smallish chance, maybe, you know, I'll not say smallish, I'll say maybe 40-50% odd chance of, you know, giving you a market matching to beating returns.
Right.
Is my guess at this point.
Right.
That's fair. Yeah.
I own Telstra. It's a buy for us, sell at share advisor. I share your view, Doc, that at the current price in particular, I think what I got wrong when I bought at higher price and recommended at higher prices, and we do get things wrong. I will say, for what it's worth, we are beating the market overall. So we get some calls wrong, but overall, if we get enough right, we're beating the market, which we are at ShareAdvisor. Telstra for me is the thesis was always the mobile business was strong, the landline business was weak, but the mobile business would well and truly offset the growth that would offset the decline of the landline business. Mm. And what I completely messed up was the timing and the size of those changes. So I still think that's going to be true, by the way. I still expect the mobile business to do really, really well. The problem was there was too much of the value of the then Telstra in that landline business that has evaporated. Mm. And so that's the mistake in the past. I would say to PowerPig, the price you paid, you should ignore. We talk about anchoring all the time. It's very hard to do because you're sitting on some losses and going, oh, this really sucks. The question is, if you cashed out today, would you buy in again? And at the current price, I do think that most of the bad news is hopefully priced in. I expect fully that 5G will be a boon for Telstra. I think it will continue to do well. It will continue to dominate the mobile space. And as long as it does that, I think it's going to be a good investment from the current price. I could well still be wrong, but that's my view on balance. I think the risk and reward is in Telstra's favor.
Okay.
Mate, I'm going to go to Wesfarmers then and Coles. PowerPig doesn't ask about Coles particularly, although I assume he or she owns some Coles because of the demerger. So let's look at Wesfarmers and Coles. Wesfarmers, of course, famously owned Coles, and people see Wesfarmers as a Coles kind of, interchangeably. Wesfarmers has always, though, been an investment conglomerate, not a retailer. And so I wasn't surprised to see it demerge the Coles business onto the market. It's going to basically put its money where the best opportunities are. It decided that Coles wasn't it. And so it was going to give those Coles shares to its shareholders and then let them make the decision. Wesfarmers, of course, though, still owns Bunnings, Kmart, Target, some coal business, some insurance chemicals business. Big conglomerate at Wesfarmers. Your thoughts on Wesfarmers and or Coles?
I actually don't have much thoughts on Wesfarmers. Of course, those are two companies that I don't actually follow that closely. And, you know, it's not even in the tech sector. So it's something that I you know, it's too big for me, for my taste, and also not in the tech space. If it was big in tech, I would follow it. So I really don't have a view. I mean, I have a view on Coles. I mean, it's very hard to grow that business, right? Because, I mean, you know, we've got Coles, we've got Woolies, we've got Aldi. I mean, how much can you grow? You know, you can only grow by population, right? Yeah, I mean, it's just really hard. So so you need to be value conscious, you know, the price you pay at certain price is probably a good buy. I just don't know what that price is.
That's fair. I think Wesfarmers is, I think you're right actually, Doc. So we've got both of them as a buy currently at ShareAdvisor, where we've had Wesfarmers already on the scorecard before that. Also had a couple of other services or one other service. For me, I'm actually, there's still buyers as a standard recommendation, but I am looking forward to this current earnings season to see what the numbers are separately. I think that'll tell us a lot more about the two businesses. I'm probably keener on Wesfarmers than Coles for growth, probably keener on Coles than Wesfarmers when it comes to yield. And so, again, depending on what the individual investor is looking for, I like the Wesfarmers culture. They've traditionally done a very good job of recycling capital. I think they'll continue to do that. And frankly, Coles was very capital heavy. Wesfarmers sans Coles is actually a much lighter capital business. Not exactly a software business, but much less capital per dollar of profit. So there should be a positive there for the company. We'll see whether that comes true. So this earnings season, for me, if you held the shares, and again, we can't give personal advice, I wouldn't be selling them until I saw the results of this earnings season and then working out kind of what comes from that.
Motley Fool Money.
Mate, one last piece of feedback from members, then we'll wrap this up. Mm-hmm. And it was just a response to one of our previous podcasts. I know you don't like politics, mate, but I'm going to drag you back into the fray, or at least mention it. You don't have to. You can say mum if you want. Mm-hmm. We got a question or a comment, so a bit of both, from the podcast. And it says, somewhat rhetorically, or maybe pointedly, free trade is best. Isn't this only if all countries accept this and trade freely? This not only encompasses tariffs, but export subsidies, e.g. the EU. Now, we made the point in previous podcasts, or maybe I made the point, I'm not going to drag you into it, that we know economically that tariffs, subsidies, quotas, all those kind of protectionist measures actually retard growth, and the removal of those increases growth. That's been the centuries and centuries, I want to say four centuries probably, of history suggests that when trade barriers are lowered, then international trade flourishes, and when international trade flourishes, living standards improve and increase. So I think I accept the comment that's being made. Isn't it only if all countries accept it? Well, yeah, kind of it is. But we know that even relative lowering of barriers, not every single one, I don't think we can be that broad and that definitive. But generally speaking, whenever a trade barrier is lowered, even if only slightly, even if only in some areas, some categories, international trade increases, improves, standards of living improve. The reverse is also true. As barriers go up, it retards in growth of the global economy. And I think you can say, well, I'm not lowering unless you do, or you've got barriers, I haven't got barriers. And I think we shouldn't be patsies, again, country by country, region by region. You can say, well, I'm not lowering until they do, and that's all fine. But to some degree, all of the global free trade networks, whether it's NAFTA, whether it's the Australian free trade one, whether it's the new, what's that one now, the one excluding the US?
I think we have one with Japan as well, right?
We've got one with Japan.
Then there's the Pacific, whatever something it's called.
That's right. So that one excluding the US now.
Yeah.
The countries are voluntarily coming into these things because they know these things work, right? Yeah. And so our point is not to say, well, someone's a winner, someone's a loser. And again, we're not trying to play politics. We're trying to look at policies and say, generally speaking, freer trade, if we want to call it that, lower barriers are better than higher barriers. And the more we can have those come down, the better. If they go back up, even if it's justified, even if on a moral, ethical level, you say, well, they're charging me, so I'm going to charge them, it's actually negative for everybody. And so it's one of those things where sometimes you might not get a win-lose or a lose-win, but a win-win is just if any barriers come down, then everyone is better off. And I think as an economic, I don't think you find any serious economist who would disagree with that theory.
I have nothing. I just love that comment. I'm going to just now, instead of saying free trade, I'm just going to say freer trade.
There you go.
And then we win, right? I have nothing else to add. I think that's you know, it's a good point.
And I understand the questioner's point. Yeah. I think it's a fair.
It's a fair point.
It's a fair point. I just would say, let's not lose the forest for the trees, right? Yeah. We could say, well, I'm not doing it unless you do, and then we're all poorer for it. Sometimes being right is expensive. Sometimes being magnanimous, if I can use that word, is actually better off. And maybe sometimes just saying, well, it's imperfect, but as our boss would say, perfect is the enemy of good.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think we can embrace that, and that's probably a better economic outcome.
Absolutely.
Mate, that wraps us up, our very first podcast together for 2019. Listeners, we hope you've enjoyed it. And as I've said previously, if you want to get in touch with us, email us at info@fool.com.au or hit us up on Twitter @TheMotleyFoolAU or look up Scott Phillips or Anirban Mahanti, and we will happily chat with you, answer your questions, and hopefully cover one or two of them in the podcast. And before we go, don't forget you can subscribe, and you should, to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a big 5-star rating. Tell your friends, leave us a review if you don't mind. If you're enjoying it, then there's a fair chance that other people will too. And that's the best way for them to find out about this free, hopefully a bit of fun, Motley Fool Money podcast. And don't forget you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox. Just go to fool.com.au/Triple M.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.